to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan this Thursday, June 2, 2022. A top U.S. envoy in South Sudan says his country will continue to impose sanctions on South Sudanese individuals blocking the road to peace.
And one of the tools we've used, it's blunt, but we've used it, is sanctions. Whether it has any real impact on the individual's ability to do things or not. For some of the individuals we've sanctioned, they certainly believe it has impacted them.
And a South Sudanese health official says the rate of HIV/AIDS infections in the country is jumping up.
We have an increasing incidence in terms of number of people tested positive. But again, we also see that the numbers have also increased because we have also increased our testing rate.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A top U.S. envoy in South Sudan says Washington will continue to impose sanctions on individuals obstructing efforts to restore peace in South Sudan. David Rains, the charge d'affaires at the U.S. Embassy in Juba, told reporters Thursday the transitional government of national unity in South Sudan seems to condone impunity by not holding perpetrators of violence accountable. For VOA News, Dengai Deng reports from Juba.
U.S. Embassy Charge d'Affaires David Rains, who is wrapping up his stay in South Sudan this week, says the U.S. will be left with no option but to impose sanctions against individuals who would continue to obstruct the peace process in South Sudan. Rains says some leaders are not happy with the sanctions and U.N. Security Council arms embargo because they don't like to be called out for failing to do what they said they would do.
We will continue to support this country to the degree that we can, but we're also going to continue to look for ways to do it in ways that don't enable behavior that simply continues to stall and try and run out the clock or whatever metaphor you want to use. It's now one of the tools we've used, it's blunt, but we've used it, is sanctions. Whether it has any real impact on the individual's ability to do things or not. For some of the individuals we sanctioned, they certainly believe it has impacted them.
Ambassador Rains says the South Sudan government seems to condone impunity by not holding the perpetrators of violence accountable, citing the example of the commissioners of Cochin and Mayandit counties in Unity State. He says both men have continued to serve in their post even after the ceasefire monitoring body concluded Cochin County Commissioner Kong Biel and Mayandit County Commissioner Galwang Nyang were responsible for instigating deadly violence that occurred in Laer County 2 months ago.
I have spoken out publicly asking why the commissioners in Cochin and Mayandit County are not being held accountable for what is absolutely clear is their role in the violence out there. At a minimum, they should be suspended from their office pending South Sudan's investigation into their conduct. They shouldn't be allowed to continue to fuel this conflict. That suggests we've got problems of political will. We need to change that dynamic. If that dynamic changes, the whole range of possibilities open. But the time to change that dynamic is running out.
Rains says the U.S. government wants to see full implementation of key provisions of the Political Parties Act, the Permanent Constitution, and the graduation of unified forces as stipulated in the peace deal so that the Biden administration can support elections scheduled to be held next year. South Sudan government spokesperson Michael McQuay told this program yesterday the recent decision by the UN Security Council to extend its arms embargo and targeted sanctions on certain South Sudanese individuals forces a major challenge to graduating unified forces, saying the forces have no guns. Rains says a lack of guns is not the problem in South Sudan.
The problem in South Sudan is not a shortage of weapons. Not for the military, not for the civilians, not for the militias. I've been told that Chairman Tut himself at one point admitted that this country has more than enough arms to arm its military. The position of the U.S. on the arms embargo, not just the administration, but the Congress, has been that it should stay in place until this country completes a peaceful transition to a democratically elected government by fully implementing the revitalized peace agreement that the leaders of this country agreed to, committed to, and promised to abide by.
Ambassador Ren says the recent UN Security Council to renew sanctions and an arms embargo on South Sudan provides an opportunity to apply for exceptions with proper justification if the country actually needs weapons to graduate unified forces.
Recognition was made that it might actually be a bit strict, that, for example, non-lethal assistance would be necessary, could be necessary, and shouldn't have to go through a cumbersome exemption process that will enable countries to, for example, provide uniforms and boots and other items that are also necessary for standing up the necessary unified forces. They can't ask for that. The country never has. They've never requested an exemption. If they've got a reasonable need for those weapons, we would consider a request for an exemption. That there were reasonable controls, that this wouldn't just be a subterfuge for supplying weapons to the very unauthorized people you say already have more than they need.
Renz called on the government to redouble its efforts to make the graduation of unified forces happen so that the people know it is serious about its commitment to fully implement the peace deal. The parties have yet to complete several chapters of the agreement, including one on governance, another on permanent security arrangements, and chapter 4 on the economic reforms and the justice system. The agreement mandates that the transitional government organize elections 60 days before the end of the current transitional period, in order to establish a democratically elected government. In January last year, President Salva Kiir's office said the parties agreed to extend the transitional period up to 2023 to allow full implementation of the critical task. The office of the president said the government was not prepared to organize elections, which initially were supposed to take place this year. The president's office said more time is needed to reorganize institutions in charge of democratic reforms. For VOA News, I am Deng Gaiding in Juba.
A senior health official at South Sudan National Ministry of Health says the rate of HIV infection in the country has increased. The director for HIV and sexual transmitted infections says tens of thousands of people were infected with HIV in the past 2 years. For VOA News, Viola Elias reports from Juba.
Dr. Harriet Akelo Pasquale, the Health Ministry Director for HIV and Sexually Transmitted Infection, says some 39,000 young people, both men and women in South Sudan, contracted HIV over the past 3 years, but she also points out testing has increased over the same time period.
We have an increasing incidence in terms of number of people tested positive. But again, we also see that the numbers have also increased because we have also increased our testing rate. So our testing rate have really increased from about 140 to over 400,000, which shows a massive increase. And that's why we see that in terms of the incidence, in terms of the numbers actually of people tested positive, it increased from 2019, actually, where we had the numbers was as low as 6,000 who tested positive to about 18,000 by 2021.
Dr. Pasquale says the Ministry of Health recorded 6,000 infections in 2019, 16,000 in 2020, and 18,000 in 2021. She attributes the increase in HIV-positive people to an increase in the Ministry Health outreach, saying health workers are conducting more HIV tests compared to previous years. Dr. Pasquale says most people testing positive for HIV are young adults.
The adults, so the ages between 18 and 39 years old, so these are the most affected age groups. But also, normally we have the highest prevalence among what we call the key populations. So this is where the prevalence normally is very, very high. So these are the age groups and the categories of people where we see high prevalence of the disease.
Dr. Pasquale says records shows that prior to 2019, less than 20% of South Sudanese population tested for HIV. She says that number has now risen to 37%, equivalent to 436,000 young people who voluntarily visit health centers in 2021. South Sudan has more than 160 health facilities, which offers voluntary HIV testing and counseling services. Pasquale says although more people are getting tested these days, the issue of stigma still remains an obstacle in their efforts to stop HIV and AIDS infection among communities.
Our estimates shows that in South Sudan, we do have 183,000 people expected to be living with HIV/AIDS. But from what we have and the numbers based on those who are on treatment, we only have 47,000 who are put on treatment. So we still have a huge gap for living with the disease.
In 2021, the World Health Organization estimated the HIV infection rate at 2.1% worldwide. More than 170,000 people are believed to be living with HIV. That's more than double the 2020 WHO projection of 1%. HIV and AIDS virus are transmitted through unprotected sexual contact with an infected person, blood transfusion or sharing needles, syringes or other injection equipment, among others. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias. In Juba.
Still in Juba, some young men and women in South Sudan's capital Juba say poaching is destroying the country's ecosystem. An official with the Ministry of Wildlife says the availability of firearms in the hands of civilians increases the amount of poaching across the country. For VOA News, David Monodanga reports from Washington.
Conflict and insecurity in South Sudan have resulted in a breakdown of some public institutions, threatening wildlife populations and exacerbating illicit trade in bushmeat, rare species, and ivory. Last week, images of the slain animals were posted on Facebook, revealing poachers posing with elephants, buffalo, giraffes, and other endangered species they killed in Akobo of Jonglei Estate. Mien Matthew, a member of Boma Safari, a South Sudanese tour and travel company, says poaching destroys the country's ecosystem and biodiversity.
It is important that we conserve, protect, provide a policy that continue into the future to protect this wildlife. So by protecting our wildlife, by delineating the forest cover so that we gazette most of the forest cover into protected areas, we'll be able to condone off and reduce the number of human life conflict. Therefore, we will have a lot of investors coming into the country who will invest in the tourism.
Matthew says poaching increases wildlife conflicts and encourages migration of animals to neighboring countries.
They are running away, and some of them, we start to lose game slowly. So poaching is something we must discourage. It's something that we should not condone. It's something that the government must come up with stringent measures to ensure that those who continue to practice these heinous crimes against our wildlife must be arrested and must face the law.
Lupai Samuel, director of I Am Peace, an initiative that promotes local tourism, says conserving wildlife and encouraging South Sudan's tourism opportunities connects people across the country.
It also goes beyond. It means connecting with nature. It means connecting with what can sell South Sudan out there to make us proud of our country. And so selling the local tourism of this country means that other people are going to know South Sudan besides the wars that they hear and besides all the horrible things we hear about South Sudan.
Insecurity in South Sudan has nurtured an illegal ivory trafficking route in the country. Ivory is either flown out of South Sudan via Juba International Airport or driven south to Uganda via the border crossings at Nimule or Oraba. Mario Jimmy, Assistant Director of Tourism Investment in South Sudan's Wildlife Conservation and Tourism Ministry, says poaching is even worse in the Bandiagara National Park in central and eastern Equatorial States.
In Bandiagara now, almost on a daily basis, the life of wildlife species are in danger. And why the youth are most involved in hunting the wildlife species? Because of lack of income. Others take advantage of looking for wildlife meat plus some other things which can make them get money.
Jimmy says unless communities are educated on the importance of wildlife, poaching will never stop. And he says the proliferation of illegal firearms among citizens presents a major obstacle to wildlife authorities.
Most of the community members, they are ex-soldiers. Up to now, they're still holding many illegal firearms, and that's one of the challenges, really, which cannot allow others' laws or policy to be put together. Disarming the civilians' illegal firearms at their hands. If all those guns will be collected, then only left with the regular organized forces like wildlife, police, prisons, SSPDF, and national security, then the reduced number of illegal hunting animals will be realized.
South Sudan is a member of several organizations that combat wildlife and ivory trafficking, including the 2014 Arusha Declaration on Regional Conservation and Combating Wildlife Stroke Environmental Crime, the Clinton Global Initiative, and Interpol, but poaching continues. There are about 100 rangers and one car to cover 5 protected areas in western Equatorial State. Officials say that is not nearly enough. For VOA News, I am David Monodanga in Washington.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, tension is growing as Rwanda and DRC exchange accusations. Find out why after the break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what puts a smile on your face?
I have a group called Lishi. It's a group full of young children. So when I dance with them, it puts a smile on my face. Makes me happy.
What puts a smile on my face is good food and good people.
Okay, when I see good food and good friends around, well, I smile.
My husband, to be, puts a smile on my face. He cracks jokes. He likes cracking jokes, and that makes me happy.
One thing that puts a smile on my face is to see somebody who has been in trouble or who has had great challenges, and then he has broken through, his life is better, their lives have improved, their marriages, their business. It brings joy to my heart to see people becoming better.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. The current tension between the governments of the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda over rebel groups in eastern DRC has the African Union on the edge. Some security analysts warn that war between Rwanda and DRC will send the region into a spiral of conflict. Darren Taylor has more from Johannesburg.
Willem Els is a senior researcher at the Institute for Security Studies in Pretoria. He describes the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo as having perfect conditions for the myriad of rebellions and proxy wars that have unfolded there over 3 decades.
It is volatile. It's an area where you've got extremely porous borders. There's a lot of trade, but also a very big illicit economy. On the other hand, is the lack of good governance in that area led to a lot of dissent and discontent with the people in the area, with the government of DRC.
He says extremist groups use the eastern DRC to hide in secret training camps where they plan attacks elsewhere in Africa.
You have Ugandan forces that actually moved across the border after there was a twin attack near the parliament buildings in Kampala by a terrorist group, the Allied Democratic Forces, that actually originated in Uganda but is now based in the Kivu, North Kivu area of DRC.
The Allied Democratic Forces, the ADF, claims allegiance to the Islamic State militant group. African affairs analyst Isaac Komo says there's credible evidence to suggest that some of the DRC's neighbors are meddling in the country.
There are strong allegations which say that basically there's another group which is actually masquerading as the ADF under the Ugandans. And this group is highly sophisticated, well-trained, well-equipped.
Speaking during a recent webinar presented by South Africa's Channel Africa, Komo said attacks blamed on the ADF in recent years unfolded with remarkable precision, such as the targeting of a Tanzanian military base.
In that attack, the ADF attacked at sunset, and they continued the attack throughout the night to the early hours of the morning. The ADF rebels, they had night sight equipment, And they also were able to jam the Tanzanian communication. Those are not capabilities which an ADF rebel group would have. Those are highly sophisticated military capabilities which the Tanzanian forces do not have, the DRC forces do not have.
The Ugandan government has consistently denied supporting rebels in the DRC. For several years, rebel groups in various parts of the continent have been known to use such combat technology. Different reports over the years, including a 2012 Reuters news story, have said militia groups in the DRC use night vision technology. Cormor says growing numbers of Congolese accuse Rwanda of supporting DRC's M23 rebels, whose attacks are also becoming increasingly well-coordinated. Rwanda denies the allegations and has accused the DRC military of shelling across the border into Rwandan territory. Cormor says at the heart of all the conflict is Eastern DRC's mineral wealth. He says all parties, including more than 100 armed militias, are fighting for a share of the region's vast natural resources.
Eastern DRC, where the fighting and instability is taking place, is one of the most mineral-endowed areas of the earth, from coltan for your computers and your cell phones to uranium. There's gold, there is everything there, there is nickel, there is the whole lot.
To add to all of this, Russia has shown interest in the region, with Congolese protesters even calling on the Kremlin to help the DRC against Rwanda. The Russian mercenary company Wagner operates in Mali and the Central African Republic, which borders the DRC. The Russian government says it's not involved in those operations. The US Defense Department says Moscow's strategy is to prop up weak African leaders in exchange for economic or other advantages. The Russian government does this, it says, by deploying mercenaries, disinformation, election interference, arms for resources deals, and opaque contracts. The Russian government, however, denies those allegations. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
From Johannesburg, we move to Central Africa. Central African Republic refugees in Cameroon have started returning home after fleeing political and sectarian violence there since 2014. There are around 300,000 Central African refugees in Cameroon, most of them women and children. Hundreds have agreed to return home after Bangui promised peace has returned to their towns and villages. Muki Edwin Kinzika reports from Gado Bazere on Cameroon's border with Central African Republic.
Cameroonian officials handed out food and blankets at a camp in Gado Bazere Wednesday to about 300 Central African refugees who agreed to return home. Gado Bazere hosts more than 30,000 CAR refugees out of 300,000 who fled conflict. 35-year-old farmer Robert Bisa is one of the refugees who is returning this week to the Central African Republic. He left the CAR in 2017 after a rebel attack on a military base killed civilians and destroyed the shop where he sold his produce.
Maintenant, je voulais rentrer chez moi. Je me sens bien pour rentrer.
Bisa says he received assurances from his family back home that peace has returned to his village in the south of the CAR. He says he intends to go back to his farm and grow beans and groundnuts. Cameroon authorities and the UN's refugee agency, the UNHCR, say 2,500 refugees, most of them women and children, have agreed to return home before the end of this year. But UNHCR Cameroon representative Olivier Bier says most of the refugees in Cameroon are still reluctant.
Nous ne sommes pas encore dans une situation de rapatriement promu.
Bier says a majority of the refugees have not accepted to voluntarily return because security is unstable in the CAR. But he says there are some towns and villages that have been pacified by the CAR's military. A CAR official receiving the refugees on the border said they would be socially and economically reintegrated and that their safety and security would be assured. Cameroon's Territorial Administration Minister Paul Atanganji says militaries on both sides will protect refugees as they were returning home. Nji says there are still problems of CAR rebels crossing into Cameroon to steal supplies and abduct civilians for ransom.
It is important to reiterate the instructions of President Paul Biya that the departure must be voluntary and the convoy must have all the necessary security measures. We have asked the security forces in Cameroon to accompany the convoy. And by the time we get to the boundaries, the security forces from the neighboring country will continue with the convoy.
Violence erupted among armed groups in the CAR in 2013 when the then president François Bozizé was ousted by the Seleka, a Muslim minority rebel coalition. In January 2021, hundreds of CAR civilians fled sporadic clashes after the presidential election, many of them to Cameroon. The UN says since 2013, close to 1 million Central Africans have fled conflict to neighboring Cameroon, Chad, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Nigeria. The voluntary repatriation of CAR refugees began in 2016, but was suspended in 2020 due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Gado Bajere, Cameroon.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
That's all we prepared for you this Thursday. We now end the show with Emmanuel Kembe and the song Shen Shen.
The voice of the innocent blood cries out with heartrending insistence in the heart of the person who killed. If you want peace, work for justice, and for the heads of the states and political leaders must not sacrifice the lives of their fellow citizens. Shen Shen, this song tells about the actual war situation in South Sudan.
Shen 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 Mama.
We've been listening to Emmanuel Kembe and the song Shen Shen. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for taking time to be with us this evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.